Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's March 14th, 2019. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Hoffman's up north with the Iditarod issue, and we'll be here in a day or so. Senator Schauer, Senator Wachowski, and myself, Stedman. So we have a virtual full committee almost. We have two items on the agenda today. We're going to bring up Senate Bill 20, which is the operating budget. Then we're going to follow that up with Senate Bill 38, which is the disaster relief supplemental. For those watching at home, you'll hear that referred to a lot at the table as a fast-track supplemental. All that means, it is a supplemental budget changes for FY19 with an early effective date so we could release the money to deal with the disaster, earthquake disaster, and a couple other little items. And the first item up will be the operating budget and SB 20. What we'll be doing there is just adopting a rewrite with no changes in the governor's submission to conform with the structure that the legislature works in, and we'll be setting both those items aside. So, Madam Co-Chair, could I get a motion to adopt version S as a working document?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt version S as our working document for Senate Bill 20.
Okay, I'll object for purpose of explanation and ask Mr. Teal from Legislative Finance to come forward. And Mr. Teal, when he's ready in the hot seat, he'll explain the purpose for those at the committee and for those at home so everybody has a clear understanding of what this document is and is not. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. The bill in front of you, the committee substitute for sponsor, substitute SB 20 version S, is designed to simplify the amendment process. It does that by incorporating all the superficial changes now so that amendments that the committee makes later don't get lost in the noise of relocated sections, corrected typos, and language modified to meet legislative drafting standards. And it's that noise, and only that noise, that's addressed in this bill. I don't intend to walk through each of the changes, but I do want to assure all of you that OMB has reviewed the bill, the changes to the bill, and reports that the CS retains the original intent. And of course, the transactions are identical for version M and version S. So same bill, just cleaned up a bit so that amendments are easier to give us a good starting point for amendments. And for those who wish to review the changes, there's a document posted on our website and then on this committee's website. And it will show every comma, parentheses, that's changed in the bill. And that's the change from the governor's February 13th version M and this version, and none of the changes are substantive.
So again, for those watching at home, this version S will be the document that the subcommittees will then adopt amendments to, and we'll have the Senate Finance version come back to the table sometime in the next few weeks after the subcommittee process is done. So this is just a preliminary step in several more weeks of work. With that, I'd like to go ahead and remove my objection to adoption of version S as our working document. Do we have further objections to adoption of version S? Seeing none, well, version S on Senate Bill 20 is adopted. We will have a brief at ease while we set up for the next presenter. We're at ease. I'd like to go ahead and come back on the record. Next item up in the work order today is Senate Bill 38, Disaster Supplemental. And I'd like to have representation from the Office of Management and Budget. Ms. Lacey Sanders, come forward, please. She's got a presentation that she wants to do. After that, we'll look to adopt a committee substitute, and then we'll have explanations on that committee substitute from staff support to the Finance Committee. So with that, Ms. Sanders, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then take the public through your presentation so they get a good understanding of our response to this disaster, please.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lacey Sanders, Budget Director for the Office of Management and Budget. Today I'm going to walk through the Disaster Relief Supplemental Bill, SB 38, that is before the committee. The FY 2019 Disaster Supplemental Bill, I did briefly provide the committee an overview of this earlier in the session, but the urgency of moving this bill along has increased due to the balance in the Disaster Relief Fund. There are several pieces to the Disaster Supplemental Bill. The majority of the items relate to the 2018 Cook Inlet earthquake. There is a capitalization of the Disaster Relief Fund. There is funding requested for the Federal Highway Administration funds, and there are requests for state facilities costs due to damage that are not uncovered by insurance. The item that falls outside of the Cook Inlet earthquake is the FY 2019 fire suppression activity within the Department of Natural Resources. And I will walk through each one of these momentarily. The total bill is this. The original bill that was requested totaled $139,300,000. Of that, just over $100 million is federal funds, and $37,300,000 is general funds. The slide number 4 reflects the history of appropriations that were made and the request for the 2019 supplemental related to disasters. As you can see, it varies from year to year depending on what has happened in the year. Disasters are unpredictable, and therefore we're unable to see a current trend between the requests and the history. Slide number 5 breaks down the requests. The first item is an appropriation request to the Department of Natural Resources, as I mentioned earlier, for fire suppression activity totaling $7.9 million. This item has been underfunded in the operating budget for the last several years. There is a corresponding increment in the FY 20 budget to bring the amount of funding for fire suppression to a more historical average. The second item is an appropriation request for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. It totals $65 million of federal receipts with a $6.5 million match. This will be used over the fiscal years 2019 and 2020 as the spring comes and the department is able to start identifying work that needs to be completed on the roads. The next item is the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities request for $1 million. This will actually encompass all agencies' needs that may be are not covered by insurance costs. For example, there are parking lots and sidewalks damaged to state facilities that are not covered under insurance, and the Department of Transportation will work with those agencies to identify the repairs that need to be made and get those costs covered. The last item is a fund capitalization of the Disaster Relief Fund. The request is for $21,900,700. This was an original request as of January 2019 that would be needed to address the Cook Inlet earthquake. the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs manages the Disaster Relief Fund and has provided us with additional information that has reduced this amount to approximately $12.2 million. However, we would like to move forward with the request of $21 million. Allow the capitalization of the Disaster Relief Fund. It's an additional $9.7 million so that we're going into the spring breakup or potential flooding disasters that may happen in the spring so that the department can respond to those disasters. Are there no questions?
Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. So going back to the previous slide, you said there's an extra $9 million on that for fund capitalization. Is that typical? Is that what the organization has done in the past to forward fund to the degree of $9 million and kind of hold it there in case?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I don't know that there is a typical a level that is requested. Last session, the legislature did deposit, I believe it was close to $10 million in additional funding into the fund to bring the balance back up to a sustainable amount. The deposits in prior years had been very low, $2 million annually, and it was bringing the balance of the fund significantly low. On the next slide that I'm going to show you, it'll show you the balance as of July 1 each year. Again, disasters are unpredictable, so it's difficult to determine what a sufficient balance is. The $10 million or $9.7 million balance would allow the department to respond to needs. Recent conversations with the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs, we are working to identify if there are additional costs above the $12 million that's been requested in this supplemental request to respond to the Cook Inlet earthquake. There may be additional needs outside of what is requested in this bill as well for that specific disaster. The 9.7 would allow the department to respond to any other disasters that may occur in the time frame of the spring or going into next fall.
Okay. Senator Schauer and Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the end of the year, if the money's not used, where does it go?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, it sits in the fund. It doesn't go anywhere. It stays in the fund until it's utilized for a specific disaster.
And that rolls over year after year, stays the same?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, yes, it does.
So to put a finer point on, is this a, this a sweepable fund?
Chair Stedman, no, this is not a sweepable fund. We are capitalizing the fund, therefore the money stays in there and flows out without further appropriation.
Senator Bishop and then Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Lacey. I appreciate your comments on this. I just, and you mentioned breakup and flooding, et cetera, and that's for the additional $9 million. I'm sure DOT has already thought of this, but I just ask, have they built enough in this budget? Because after breakup and after the frost has gone out of the ground, you're going to get a different look on these roads in these buildings that have been, you know, we looked at those in January and we built a number, and you're going to have a different look in the spring. So have you built enough contingency in here is what I'm asking, and is this going to be enough, or are we going to be looking at another supplemental next year? Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it is my understanding for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities request of $65 million and $6.5 million match that this is the high end of their estimate of what would be needed for roads as spring thaw occurs and they're able to see the damage that was actually completed. Regarding the capitalization of the Disaster Relief Fund, we may be back to the committee or to the legislature with additional requests if the estimate of the $12 million isn't sufficient to cover the costs. The Department of Military and Veteran Affairs is working on outlining what those maximum costs could be, and we will provide those as soon as that information is available.
And for those watching at home, this is, a fast-track supplemental budget, which basically has an earlier effective date. We'll still have our normal FY20 budget and possibly other issues dealing within that budget dealing with the FY19 current year we're in. So we'll still have time until we adjourn here in May to address any immediate financial needs that may surface with the spring thaw. So we'll be keeping track of that. Also, that's a good point to bring up. Senator Machicki.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So roughly 148 million, 140 is dedicated toward response and the capitalization of the fund. What is the total of sort of what you believe is going to be spent from what you know right now of that 140?
Senator Machicki, are you referring specifically to the disaster relief fund?
Well, I'm referring to you're capitalizing the disaster relief fund, but there's significant requests for the earthquake response. I'm assuming that you're already assuming part of the disaster relief fund is going to be spent in the response.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, yes. The number that I have received on state cost, total state cost, at a maximum could be up to $60 million for state costs. However, that only applies to the disaster relief fund, provide that caveat. That cost is dependent upon what is covered by the federal government and what is not. And the department, that's what I was speaking to earlier, the department is working through that analysis to see what the additional need may be. On the next slide, I'll walk through the fund balance. There was existing funding in the disaster relief fund, and that has been completely obligated. And we're asking for $12 million here, with an additional 9.7 that could be utilized towards the Cook Inlet earthquake if needed. But we anticipate that there may be more need for general funds deposited into the disaster relief fund. We don't have a solid number to give you right now.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. It is concerning that there could be another several tens of millions of dollars. What is the thought process or evaluation process of repairing some of these buildings? And I'll give you an example. When you look at Eagle River, the school district, you have greening that was damaged, middle school, and I believe Eagle River Elementary. Has there been any discussion with the school district about maybe closing those schools and not repairing them and selling them as is and looking at the excess capacity in and around the Eagle River area to redistribute students, things of that nature? I mean, it's one thing just to simply say this is what we have on hand and we're going to repair everything when maybe that's not, in any case-by-case scenario, maybe that's not the best option.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, I can't speak to the actual conversations that are going on. I do have a lifeline on the phone. Brian Fisher, the state's coordinating officer, is available. He may be able to speak to that information.
Yeah, I was going to bring him up during public testimony, but I see he's online and with the department, so we'll bring him up to see if Mr. Fisher heard that question or if he would... after he introduces himself, if you would like to help us with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Brian Fisher. I'm an emergency program manager in the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and the state coordinating officer for the 2018 Cook Inlet earthquake disaster. And I can speak to that question. So through the chair to Senator Von Imhoff, speaking directly about the schools that were affected in Eagle River in the Anchorage School District, it's my understanding that at this point in time, the school district is looking at repairing both of those schools that have significant damage, Greening Middle School and Eagle River Elementary School, repairing them in place. Their engineers have looked and done a cost analysis on what it would cost to demolish those schools and rebuild them or rebuild them in a different place or repair them. And it looks like the cost at this time it's more cost effective to repair those schools. The process moving forward, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, and our agency will work directly with the school district to look at their cost estimates and determine what is the most reasonable and cost-effective method going forward. If it's decided to repair, then funding would be made available by FEMA and our agency through the DRF to repair those two school buildings back to what the pre-disaster condition was, including any upgrades for codes and standards, those kind of things.
Okay. I'll follow up, and then we're going to go to Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So thank you, Mr. Fisher. Actually, the most cost-effective would be to consolidate schools and capture excess capacity and not repair the two schools. And that's, I think, a conversation. I'm not sure how to go forward with the school district about that, but I'm just putting it out there. I think the other issue, though, is we have quite a bit of capital projects for road repairs each year and federal matching funds, and I think it would be nice to have a list of the roads that we're looking to repair under this earthquake funds and the roads that we're already going to repair this coming summer under our regular DOT and see if there's any matching. So just so we're not repairing the same road twice or paying to repair the same road twice. So
Senator Von Imhoff, we can take a look at that. We just finished the DOT subcommittee this morning. We have a couple more subcommittees scheduled. So we will bring that to the DOT subcommittee and ask them on the cross-pollination question. And on the policy question that was brought up on the schools, I think that's something that the legislature should be briefed on and have a discussion, a policy discussion on, because we may come up with a different conclusion, that being a conclusion leaning more towards consolidation and streamlining versus rebuilding an old cinder block building. So I think we'll volunteer to participate in that discussion. Senator Schauer.
Yes, sir. I was wondering if the speaker there could do the same thing for Houston, the same synopsis, because we're in the same boat there with whether to rebuild it or not, if he has the same update for us, because that will drive this as well.
Yeah, we'll be taking a look at the entire earthquake zone. Make sure we make the best informed decision possible in the long-term interest, not the short-term gain of some federal money. Have other questions before she continues on? Senator Machicki.
I just want a clarification, and I sent a note to the co-chair as well. The money you're asking for today is not related to school repair. Is that correct? Isn't that primarily road and state facility repairs, or could some of it also be directed towards schools?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the disaster relief fund is utilized to respond to disasters. The Cook Inlet earthquake was declared as a disaster and is used for communities. The schools can apply for the funding. Okay. It is also in response to what they call individual assistance and so on and so forth. So it's not just roads.
And that's residential damage as well then, perhaps, is?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. Mr. Brian Fisher could probably speak to more details on residential, but I believe that falls into that category as well.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue with your presentation, and we'll come back to Mr. Fisher in public testimony and see what he has to say in a broader view also.
Slide number six is a summary of the fund balance and of the disaster relief fund as of July 1 each fiscal year. This is a point in time snapshot for the committee, and these are the unobligated balances of the fund at a point in time. I would like to move on to the next slide, which is slide seven, which is as of March 5th, the unobligated balance in the disaster relief fund is $362,900, and it is expected to be fully expended by April 1st, 2019. Which is why we're asking for urgency in moving this bill through the process.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Who has the discretion to pay out to issue payments from the Disaster Relief Fund? And are those payments done through requests for proposals, or are there sole source contracts that are issued?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the Department of Military and Veteran Affairs, Homeland Security and Emergency Management is the one who administers the Disaster Relief Fund. I would like to call on Brian to answer
we'll,
your second
We'll question. Bring him up in public testimony, otherwise we'll be going back and forth like a yo-yo. Some of the that question could be repeated in the public testimony. We'll be bringing him up to explain his role, and we may have a litany of questions for him. Go ahead and continue.
The Office of Management and Budget recently submitted two amendments to this bill. There is additional, an additional need in the Department of the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities for $1 million of unrestricted general funds for costs associated with the Cook Inlet earthquake that are not covered by the federal agencies, the Federal Highway Administration or the Federal Emergency Management Agency. These costs are more administrative in nature or can be costs that are not reimbursable. There may be, cost for a person to process payments or travel costs that are not covered by individual projects. The $1 million is an estimate, but they believe it should be sufficient to cover their costs. Excuse me. The Department of Labor and Workforce Development is requesting an additional $1 million in federal receipt authority to provide assistance to individuals for whether their employment or self-employment was lost or interrupted during the disaster. They have existing federal authority in their budget that can cover a portion of this, but they do need an additional $1 million.
Okay. Senator Wilkowski and Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the DOT $1 million, two questions. Number one, has that money been spent? And number two, who will be getting that $1 million? Is there a list somewhere that we can see?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, some of that money has already been spent as they are responding to the disaster needs. And whether there is a list, I can follow up with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and outline where those, are you talking about within the agency, where those expenditures were made?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'm curious if it's within the agency or if it's going to private contractors.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, this is within the agency. These are individuals within the agency that are working on disaster response.
Quick follow-up, and we'll go to the next.
Is that paying them for like overtime services, or I mean, I assume these are employees who are salaried already, right?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, if I can give you an example of when somebody wouldn't be covered. Department of Transportation Public Facilities employees are very project specific, and so their time has to be allocated to individual projects. Those projects can't be used to cover other costs within the agency. So we have identified areas where employees are not able to charge their current salaries to a specific project, and we need to fund those positions with general funds. They wouldn't normally be covered with general funds. They would be covered with a long-term capital project, so to speak, or a specific federal project in the capital
Senator
budget.
Bishop.
I see Senator Wilkowski looking. He was going down the same line of questioning I was, and Lacey explained it. Some of this is going to be a match to the federal receipt authority for the disaster relief on this DOT funds, I would think. But anyway, Department of Labor, if you can't answer this, there's a young lady in the second row that could answer it. is the million Fed receipt authority, is that for UI, could it be used for UI benefits, or we're looking at job training?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, it's my understanding it's for potential wages that were lost during the disaster. If you'd like, we can bring Paloma Harbor up to provide additional information, but it's fine. Lost wages.
That's fine.
Okay. We have other questions on slide number 8. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Just along that line of thinking, our capital budget has been so much less in the last several years because there just hasn't been the money for federal projects. Yet I don't know what the employee account has been of DOT. So if we really are trying to allocate federal state employees at DOT to specific projects, We haven't really had a lot of projects.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we do have a capital budget each year that includes significant highway funding and funding, for example, for bridge inspections and so on and so forth. We have Amanda Holland here from the Department of, well, she's from the Office of Management and Budget, but she can speak on behalf of the Department of Transportation's budget. If you'd like additional information on the PCN count, we can provide that as well.
I don't think we need to. I think the point being that we have roughly $1 billion capital budget, give or take 100 and some million a year, coming in with federal, and we do match. And we have minimized the capital budget basically down to federal match to get the $900 million, roughly $850, whatever it is, a year coming in any given year. But what Senator Von Imhoff was alluding to, we haven't had the excess revenue stream to have other projects put on top of the federal match, including this year, and we'll have that discussion at the table. And I think also dealing with some of these, this $1 million to DOT, they have some difficulty crossing appropriation lines. Is that not correct?
Through the chair, or to the chair, Senator Steadman, there are restrictions on crossing appropriation lines. I don't know if that is the case in the $1 million request. The $1 million request is really to cover costs that aren't associated with particular projects for employees that are doing work related to the Cook Inlet disaster.
Okay. We have other questions? Senator Wilson.
I just want to make sure we have a clarification that sort of a request from the committee for the details on DOT, just where the money is being spent, but also a list of specific projects that this disaster funds are all going toward.
Could you repeat that?
Yeah, just wanted to see if we can get a formal request then from the committee to the administration on where the DOT, where money is being spent in DOT specifically, and the list of the projects that are going to be funded with the disaster funds.
Right. I think Senator Wilkowski's asked that in his question, and we'll be having that breakdown of where the funds are going.
Correct. I just didn't hear a sort of a...
Oh, an affirmative...
Yes.
...response from the chairman.
Correct.
Repeating that, but yes, I probably didn't make it as clear, but yes, we're going to have that information back to the committee.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, in addition, I would like to clarify that the Department of Transportation may not know exactly at this point what project is going to be completed on the road. For example, the $65 million federal request was $6.5 million match. As the spring comes and the snow melts away, they will be able to get a better idea of what damage needs to be fixed and what extent the repairs need to be made. So we may not be able to give you an exact list project by project. At this point, it's an estimate. We can provide additional details on examples for the administrative activities for you, if that would be helpful.
Yes, as much information as you can, and particularly on the million to DOT, and you might as well throw in the labor and workforce development too, to add on to Senator Bishop's question, because we will be revisiting this, I'm pretty confident, by the end of the operating budget cycle. There's some expectation that the spring thaw will give us a surprise or two. Other questions? Okay, you want to continue your presentation?
That is actually the end of my presentation.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to have a motion from my co-chair for the adoption of version U of the CS for Senate Bill number 38, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt version U as a working document for Senate Bill 38.
Okay, and I will object for the purpose of explanation and have Mr. Pete Eklund come forward. He works for the committee and the operating head, committee aide for the operating budget. Mr. Eklund, if you could introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then take us through this committee substitute proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Pete Eklund, staff to Senator Stebbins and the committee. Mr. Chairman, the version U, the work draft you have in front of you, only has a couple changes, and Ms. Sanders just went over the two major ones, which is, if you look at version U, section one on page one, line five is the labor and workforce development $1 million for disaster unemployment assistance benefits. If you go to page two of version U, there is a word change added by legislative legal on line three. They just restated the purpose at the end of the sentence on line three of what the purpose of that $65 million of is for, and it's to the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities for Federal Highway Surface Disaster Repair. And then further on line 12 of page two is the other amendment that Ms. Sanders just spoke to, $1 million going to the Department of Transportation for non-covered service transportation costs. And lastly, Mr. Chairman, the last change is on line 22, the lapse date is the whole section three that is going to the Department of Transportation, the different appropriations have a capital project lapse date.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Eklund? Seeing none, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the adoption of the CS. Do we have any further objection to the adoption of the CS as a working document from the committee? Seeing none, we'll have adopted version U as our working document. I'll now go ahead and open up public testimony on this proposal. I'd like to go ahead and call on Mr. Fisher. And if Mr. Fisher, if you could introduce yourself again for the record and who you represent, and help the committee understand your role and your agency's role, and what other comments you want to make on this proposed supplemental budget, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Brian Fisher, the state coordinating officer for the 2018 Cook Inlet earthquake disaster, and I work for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. So briefly, and I'll try to answer the questions that came up in the earlier testimony. Our agency is responsible to implement the provisions of the Alaska Disaster Act, which is Alaska Statute 2623. So our agency does coordinate and manage the funding from the Disaster Relief Fund to other state agencies, to local governments, school districts, for repairs to infrastructure that's damaged as a result of a declared disaster. We also manage a program to Senator Machicki's question on residential damages that occur and are included in a disaster declaration. So for the 2018 Cook Inlet earthquake, the governor did declare for both what we call public assistance, which is really infrastructure, and then individual assistance is the other program. And that provides support to repair essential areas of a primary residence for homeowners affected by the earthquake, as well as essential personal property loss, things like hot water heaters and stoves, that kind of thing. So our agency manages that. On January 31st, President Trump declared a major disaster, a federal disaster for the earthquake, and includes comparable programs from the federal government. So what Ms. Sanders presented was a funding summary of what we're looking for today in order to respond to the very initial part of the recovery to this event. The presidential disaster was a little slow in coming due to the federal shutdown, so we are at the very beginning of trying to estimate costs necessary to make repairs. Like was mentioned earlier, a couple of specific schools that sustained severe damage, as well as all the other damage that's out there. We are very concerned, along with everyone else, about what's going to happen in the spring. The Federal Emergency Management Agency has never responded to what I've been calling a frozen earthquake before. So as Ms. Sanders stated, there may be future requests for additional funding once we determine the true extent of the damage here. On the infrastructure side, in general, state and local governments, tribal governments, and certain private nonprofits that provide essential government services, things like utility companies, are eligible for assistance funds, both through the state disaster relief fund and the federal one. That is, at this point, now that FEMA is here, any of the infrastructure damages that are eligible for reimbursement would be reimbursed on a 75% federal, 25% state cost share. So 25% of those eligible costs will come through through our office to manage with FEMA. And back to, there was a question about how the funding is used and if there, how our procurement's done, things like that. Our public assistance program is a reimbursable program, so we expect the applicants, think school districts or local governments, to perform the work and get that done and then request a drawdown from FEMA and the state to be reimbursed for those expenses. We are required, because this is a federal declaration, to follow all of the federal OMB guidance procurement regulations. As a matter of fact, we're doing a number of trainings this week with procurement disaster lawyers to school districts, to local agencies affected, on how to perform proper procurements. That includes some very stringent requirements for open and fair competition. It's very unusual for us to end up with sole source contracts. If a local agency needed to do that, they have to ask permission ahead of time, or they will not be reimbursed for those costs. So it's a very very rigid and strict program to be able to respond to that. On the individual assistance side, for individuals and families that have been affected, there are two programs. With the declaration from the state back in December, that opened up the Disaster Relief Fund to provide grant assistance to individuals and homeowners up to $17,450 in eligible disaster damages to their primary residence. So vacation homes and things, they're not included. Eligible damages typically are for essential living areas of a home. So if a bedroom, kitchen, bathroom had damage from the earthquake, that would be potentially reimbursable, or a grant fund up to $17,450 could be made available to that homeowner. And then, like I said earlier, personal property loss, essential personal property like hot water heaters, boilers, furnaces, those kind of things are also eligible under that program. So we began that program in December. We also utilize the second part of the state individual assistance program called temporary housing to provide rental assistance to homeowners that were displaced from their homes because they suffered major damage or the homes were destroyed. Now that FEMA is here, their programs are in place right now. We have approximately 14,000 applicants for the state program. As of today, FEMA is right around 6,000 applicants to their programs. The Alaska Administrative Code in 6 AAC 94-200 through 380 mandates that when there are a federal disaster happens, our residents have to go through FEMA and the U.S. Small Business Administration for potential low-interest loans before they can avail themselves of the state disaster assistance. So we're right in the middle of that process right now. Today we'll be communicating with all 14,000 of our applicants to let them know that process, that they need to avail themselves of federal benefits, which would be 100% federal direct to the homeowner, before they come back to the state of Alaska for any additional unmet needs that happen. And on the public assistance side, we are at the very beginning of that stage. We have conducted applicant briefings with all of the school districts and local governments and other entities, and just beginning the very, very start of developing what we call project worksheets that will have a scope of work to repair the facility to pre-disaster condition. It will look at all those things about cost effectiveness and reasonableness, current codes and standards, all of those things. And in addition, there's the potential to mitigate some of these buildings that were damaged to provide some mitigation activities to prevent further damage from future earthquakes, that kind of thing. So that's where we're at today, and I'm happy to entertain any questions that the committee has. Thank you.
The committee has a couple questions. Senator Wilson has a question. Senator Von Imhoff has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Will there be a supplemental application process for the springtime if Alaskans realize damages may occur, as Ms. Sanders said, that we don't know the extent of what may happen during the springtime thaw? I just want to make sure that there is an application process for people who may not have seen damages or realize their homes or septic systems may have been damaged or other types of building structural damages.
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Wilson, at this point, the state's assistance application period ended on February 28th of this year. Through all of December up through February, we had encouraged all survivors in the Mat-Su borough, the Kenai borough, and the municipality of Anchorage to register with our program, even if they didn't know at the time whether they had damages. With FEMA's declaration that's in place now, their registration period goes through April 1st at this point, but the governor will be making a request to FEMA to extend the FEMA registration period all the way to May 31st. So that's in process right now. We're hopeful that we will receive that. FEMA understands that we have routine disaster issues in Alaska with snow coverage and frozen ground and damages not becoming evident until the spring. So our intent is to have FEMA's program all the way through May 31st if new damages are identified. And if it's really substantial across the state, that will be brand new for all of us to deal with. We'll have to work on that if we see substantial damages show up after breakup.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. So I'm leaning my questions more towards schools and school districts. That's an area I'm familiar with. So you might have mentioned this already, but my first question is there a deadline by which the schools can submit their formal request for repairs for specific schools?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, thank you for the question. There is a number of deadlines in the FEMA process, but I can tell you all three of the school districts have already submitted their initial request. They met the deadline. It's called a request for public assistance. So they're in the program now, and we'll be working with them through the entire timeline to make sure we can develop scopes of work and estimates for any of the repairs that have to happen to any school district facilities in the three jurisdictions.
Okay. Thank you. So they've already submitted the request, so clearly you have an idea of the scope of funds needed in those areas, which is how you were able to create your budget. So I'm making that assumption. The question is, though, is did you, in your analysis, ask the school districts to come up with maybe a plan A and a plan B? And or did you plan B, assuming that they may decide to close a school, or has every school that's been damaged are they seeking repairs for every single school? And do you know of any schools that may be closed down and not reopened at all?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, thank you for those questions. The budget that was presented for the supplemental bill was based on a preliminary damage assessment that was conducted in December. That was with our office, the state of Alaska, FEMA, and each individual applicant, the school districts being one of them. So that was based on very, very rough preliminary estimates that the school district was able to develop with their engineering staff or contractors that they had on what they could see at the time. So that's what the initial budget was based upon. As part of this process, as we move forward with public assistance, FEMA will bring in their own engineers and folks like that from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to work side by side with the school districts to look at every single building that had damage. And like I said in my previous answer, look at things that are reasonable and cost effective to make those repairs. So if something doesn't make sense to repair and needs to be replaced instead, for example, those conversations will be had directly with the school districts. Our agency's primary role in that is to make sure that the applicants, in this case the school districts, are being heard, and we advocate for them in their decisions. It's really their individual decisions on how they move forward and recover from this disaster, and we're there to support them in making that case with FEMA and the other federal agencies that may be involved.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher. I think in light, we've heard earlier that there could be a supplemental to the supplemental, potentially, and the fact that you stated that this was the school districts about a month after, less than a month after the earthquake had brought forth a rough estimate in a very timely manner, and I commend them. But I did hear a little bit that there is some wiggle room and negotiating room starting now and to the time that the funds are deployed to basically look at more of a long-term plan. Because in light of the Dunleavy administration to match revenue with expenses, a supplemental to the supplemental kind of negates the spirit of that. And I think it might be a good idea for all agencies to work together to make a true effort to control the costs and not necessarily use this earthquake as a way to continue systems that are really running inefficiently. And perhaps we should take this as an opportunity to maybe look at doing things differently and being a little bit more efficient. And perhaps that means to close schools and capture excess capacity. Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski and then Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to declare a potential conflict. In the interim, I work for a labor organization that represents workers in Alaska. I don't think they'll be impacted by this legislation, but erring on the side of caution, I'd like to declare a potential conflict. And then one question. Are the bids that are put out or the contracts that are issued predominantly issued on an RFP basis, or are they predominantly sole-sourced contracts?
Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilikowski, thank you for that question. They're primarily put out to bid. Back in on the 30th of November and early stages in December, some contracts were let by multiple agencies that were impacted under emergency rules that allowed them to go potentially sole source or so. That is completely allowable under FEMA's rules and regulations. But for the permanent repairs to all of the facilities that have been damaged, by and large, the practice is they have to do fair and open competition, and that would include submitting RFPs and projects out to bid for contractors to respond to. And as I stated earlier, if there was any need to do a sole source type contract, that has to be justified very, very well and approved at all levels in accordance with the state procurement laws and federal OMB circulars and all of those things.
Senator Wilkowski, you have a follow-up?
Just, could I get a list of the sole source contracts that were issued and to whom they were issued and the amounts, please, Mr. Chairman? That'd be my request.
Mr. Fisher, can you help us with that information? What's available to the committee to look at?
Thank you to the chair and to Senator Wilikowski. We can work on that. We'll have to collect that information. That's really done on an applicant-by-applicant basis, so the local government, school districts, and nonprofits would have that information. As we're developing the permanent repair projects and the reimbursement projects for the work that's already completed, we will have that. I can't say that we have all of that information today, but we will have that available and certainly willing to make that available to the committee.
Okay, thank you. Senator Schauer and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fisher, could you, the same synopsis you gave Senator Von Imhoff on the two schools that were hit in Eagle River, Houston Junior High was hit really hard. Do you have an update on that as well? Because my understanding is that probably needed to be demolished and rebuilt. So what's the status, please?
Thank you. Through the chair, I don't have the specific status with the Matanuskas, who's in the Borough School District, on Houston Middle School. I personally visited that just a couple days after the earthquake and saw how substantially damaged it was. Again, if it does need to be demolished and rebuilt, funding could be made available to the school district for what it would cost to bring that back to pre-disaster condition. If the cost to bring it back to pre-disaster condition in a repair mode is greater than 50% of what it would cost to replace the school, then that is an option that can be negotiated between the school district and FEMA, and we would be involved in those negotiations. So I haven't heard specifically from the school district what their intent is for the future for the Houston Middle School.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I'd like to make sure that I get a copy of those sole source contracts as well that Senator Wilikowski had asked for.
The information that comes to the committee is dispersed amongst all committee members equally.
Aye.
So we'll make sure that we don't lose your address there, Senator Olson.
Okay.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to just quickly declare my conflict of interest as well, as I'm an employee of the Manchester City School District, which may will benefit from this piece of legislation here before us. But also, can you determine for this for state folks? We have a lot of properties of homeowners in my district who have a sort of a issue with how the federal administration declares a primary residence in our state. We have a lot of folks who have substantial amounts of property in our district. And so how will the state determine primary residence? Will that differ from FEMA?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, thank you for that. We utilize fairly similar processes to what FEMA does. In essence, a primary residence is a home that is lived in more than half of the year, and the homeowner had to be living in that residence at the time of the earthquake. We've received a number of examples of folks that own homes in all of the jurisdictions that are maybe military and are deployed out of state and not living in the home at the time. In that case, they are not considered eligible for the grant funding that's out there. However, they may be eligible to apply for a low-interest, long-term disaster loan from the Small Business Administration. If, for example, if they're leasing their home while they're deployed out of state. So there is some federal benefit still available, but it would be largely in the form of a loan from the Small Business Administration and not a grant through the FEMA program or the state program.
That sounds kind of odd if the military posts you overseas. Am I hearing you correctly? If you were posted, for instance, overseas and your primary resident was in the earthquake zone, you don't get counted as your primary residence, even though you're over on the front line somewhere?
To the chair, that's correct. If you're not living in the home at the time of the disaster itself, then you are not considered.
Can I get a clarification?
I think we have a question from one of our military veterans here, Senator Schauer.
Clearly, I have a concern with that one. I'd like to follow up with you, Mr. Fisher, directly. And just a point of clarification, if the military member is deployed but the spouse is still living there, does that count? I'm going to assume if somebody's in the house that they still are available to receive the aid. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, that is correct. If the owner of the home has their family still living there and it's just the military member that's deployed, then they are eligible for the grant assistance. We're talking things where folks have deployed and moved their whole families out of state and for example, are renting or leasing their home to somebody else. The only relief for that, those particular cases, would be SBA loans to cover the cost of repairs.
Okay. We have other questions for Mr. Fisher. Senator Wilson, you look like you had a question. Okay, any other questions before we let him off the hook? Okay, thank you, Mr. Fisher, for testifying today and bringing forward that information to the public. It's appreciated. We have nobody else online, any LIOs or otherwise, or the off-net. Do we have anybody in the room that wants to come forward and speak on this fast-track supplemental earthquake legislation? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony, come back to the committee. Does the committee have any final questions concerning this version U before us, before we set it aside? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wondering if there's a process that we can look at changing the funding opportunities for Alaskans, that the rules just don't seem just in the status. The last question statement just has me pondering upon some of the eligibility requirements and creating additional hardships for Alaska. If there's a way that we can look at that process and a possible change to that process of how those funds are administered to help certain folks. Our office has gotten a lot of calls upon denials, which just don't seem just for...
I would expect, Senator Wilson, that as we go forward and respond to this earthquake emergency, that we'll have lessons learned, and I would imagine there'll be suggestions made to our delegation back east for potential modifications and stuff, because I'm sure no system's going to be perfect dealing with earthquakes on our frozen earthquake, as they say, because most times they don't even think about us when they set up some of these issues, us being Alaskans in our different climate. Maybe any other questions, concerns on this bill before we set it aside? Seeing none, we'll set this bill aside for further review. Next up will be the meeting tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. Excuse me, not tomorrow morning. I misspoke. I'm so enthusiastic about our next meeting. Monday at 9 a.m., we're going to have an update on the spring revenue forecast, which will basically be oil prices. Normally the cost structure doesn't change much, but we'll get a price update and a revenue update. We'll then have questions on or a presentation on the audit that's always underway over the years as far as what kind of revenue potential are we faced with in the audit review dealing with our oil and gas tax structure. I think the committee will find that very interesting. There are significant funds in discussion. And then in the future, we'll also have a discussion here at the table on how, in what direction we want to have those funds move within our categories of the general fund, the Constitution of Budget Reserve, which takes a three-quarters vote, or right into the general fund, which takes a simple majority vote, and historically how that's taken place and how that process has been suggested to be altered or changed the last couple of years and the impacts going forward. So we'll have that policy discussion. So this will be kind of an introduction to coming attractions on that subject. I think it will make it germane when you see the magnitude of the funds that we're talking about. It's in the hundreds of millions, not in the thousands. And then we'll have a presentation on the severance tax portion of our tax structure on just the order of operations, how the structure actually works. It won't be a presentation or a debate on is the tax structure high or low relative to other oil basins, or good or bad, but just what's it look like? How does it work? I've asked for the last 3 years and then the forward 2 years, being FY20 and FY21, and taking it a little further than they have in the revenue source book. Those that have looked through the revenue source book, at the back of the revenue source book, there's an income statement format that was put together years ago by the Finance Committee, and that was then adopted into the revenue source book in a stripped down version. But we're going to use that as the basis and then lay it out in more detail, including all the offsets that come down, because we're trying to keep track of our net cash flow, not only in our severance tax, but in our royalties, our property tax. There's a bill, as we all know, in the legislature now that affects that, corporate income tax, and then we have all our fish taxes and rental taxes and all that other stuff. But what we need to be paying attention to here as a net cash flow that comes to the table is referenced many times. We've got a structural deficit issue of some significant magnitude, and as my co-chair has brought up many times, the urgent need to look in the capital budget direction so we don't get overwhelmed by deferred maintenance 4 or 5 years out. So that's coming attractions for Monday morning. Hopefully we'll have all three of them up and out Monday. If not, we'll continue them on the following day on Tuesday. And then we should have a fairly good feel at the end of that presentation, those three presentations, what kind of cash flow we have to deal with this operating budget deficit and to deal with the capital budget concerns that many members have at this table and throughout the building. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody for coming this morning. We are adjourned.